The Tom Woods Show, episode 456.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Want to learn a highly marketable skill in your spare time in a way that's rigorous and yet fun and engaging and inexpensive? Then learn web technologies at Code School. Get your free account through tomwoods.com/code. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. In the recent episode with Gene Epstein, I decided to do an episode on monopolistic competition. I think it was Gene. The subject came up, and I thought this is an area that I think will show people very effectively one of the key differences between the mainstream of the economics profession and the Austrians, because in effect they see monopoly or monopoly power absolutely everywhere, that is the mainstream. And it's not clear that this is a reasonable way of looking at the market economy. So we really are going to understand better what the differences are between these two approaches in our episode today. And of course, for a case like this, I'm very glad to welcome back to the show Professor Jeff Herbener. Jeff is the chairman of the Department of Economics at Grove City College. And by the way, if you're an undergrad and you're saying, I want to learn economics from an Austrian, or you're about to become an undergrad, let's say, or your high school student is interested in this, Grove City College is a wonderful place, but the one thing it's not very good at is self-promotion. I would absolutely love to have my children at Grove City College. They would learn a ton. It takes no form of U.S. government aid whatsoever. It is absolutely independent. I'm not a paid spokesman. I'm not an endorser for Grove City College. I just voluntarily want to tell you it is a fantastic place, and the economics department is top-notch, and you're going to learn from one of the greatest minds we have in the Austrian movement around the world, and that's Jeff himself. Sean Rittenour is there. They're going to be hiring somebody else. It's fantastic. So bear Grove City College in mind. Jeff is also an editor over at the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. He's a senior fellow of the Mises Institute, and I'm glad to welcome him back. Jeff, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
This topic of monopolistic competition is, to my mind, one of these topics that maybe next to the idea of perfect competition, to which, of course, it is related, is one of the ideas that is most likely to convince the average person that there's something screwy about mainstream economics. I can at least make an argument for some of the other claims that they make, but this just drives me crazy. I want you to start off, though, by explaining what a neoclassical economist would describe as a monopoly. How do they define that term? And then let's distinguish this from what they would consider to be competition. And then finally, we'll talk about what's monopolistic competition. So start with monopoly. How do they define monopoly?
Right. So the tendency is for monopoly to be defined as the single seller of a good. And already, of course, we're in big trouble conceptually if we accept that definition, because in one sense, every person would be a monopoly supplier of a product. So Murray Rothbard says in Man, Economy, State, Ford is the monopoly supplier of Ford trucks, and so on. So this is a very problematic way of defining a monopoly and making a distinction between monopoly and competition. The key, though, analytically in the definition of monopoly is that for a monopoly supplier, the demand curve slopes downward to the right. So in order for the monopolist to sell a greater quantity of goods, the monopolist must lower the price. Now, that's what distinguishes, in their mind, in the mainstream economist mind, monopoly from competition. So in a competitive market, the assumptions are made by which they conclude that the demand curve for the product of a competitive firm is perfectly horizontal. And therefore, the competitive firm has no power to set price. The competitive firm can sell an indefinite amount of a good actually at the given price, and there would be it would sell nothing at a higher price. And so this is the analytic distinction between the two. The assumptions underlying perfect competition are completely unrealistic, and this is why neoclassical economists invented the category of monopolistic competition. Even though it seems oxymoronic to us, that was actually their attempt to be more realistic, to notice that in the real world, it's not dominated by either monopolies or perfectly competitive firms, but it seems to be this kind of middle ground. And of course, they have one other conceptual part of their framework, one other type of firm they call oligopoly, where there are just a few competitors, and then, you know, business strategy comes into the discussion about how they'll supply the good.
All right. So tell me, give me an example first, and then give me the definition of what they mean by monopolistic competition.
Okay. Well, a monopolistically competitive industry is one where each of the sellers differentiates somehow its product slightly from the other sellers. So this is what is assumed in order to make a monopolistic competitive market as opposed to a perfectly competitive one. So there's some small degree of price setting that each individual firm can engage in. Their demand curve does, in fact, slope downward to the right, except it's relatively flat compared to a monopoly. And as Rothbard points out, in actual analytics, the only distinction that can be made that's useful is between downward sloping demand curves and horizontal demand curves. And so there's really no analytical distinction between a monopoly and a monopolistically competitive firm. In doing the actual work, the analytical work with the operation. What the neoclassical economist does, though, to try to make this distinction is to say, in a monopolistically competitive market, the force of competition, the activity of the competitors who are providing nearly substitute goods, pushes away all or pushes out of the market all a monopoly profit. But again, as Rothbard points out, since all goods compete with all other goods for the business of buyers, this would also be true of monopoly firms. They too would operate only with a interest return in the long run. And so there's no analytical distinction really between these things.
Well, give me an example of monopolistic competition so people can see it. Is it like breakfast cereal, or is it like, what would be an example?
Yeah, that's right. Breakfast cereal would be a good example, as opposed to perfectly competitive firm, which would be like wheat farmers. So there, the good is completely homogeneous. There's no way of differentiating the good in the mind of the buyer from one seller to another. But the key thing about monopolistic competition, like breakfast cereals or men's dress shoes or something of the sort, would be you have a lot of sellers in the market, and they, in the mind of the buyer, they've differentiated their products to some degree, which allows the monopolistically competitive firm to charge differential prices from other competitors.
So I don't know how schooled you are in actual breakfast cereal brands.
Well, not so much as I was when my kids were younger.
All right. Well, give us a throwback to the, the 90s or something, and show me how this would work with a couple of different companies and a couple of different brands.
Okay. So let's say you have Cheerios and Wheaties, and so there would be some differential customer base for these two products. Some liking some of the kids, like the Wheaties. Maybe it's advertising that, inspires them to eat the breakfast food of champions or whatever Wheaties is. And then, Cheerios would say, well, our cereal is fortified with a million vitamins, and so it's better for the health of your kids or whatever it is. And as Romper points out, all this means in the real world is that different sellers are catering to the sort of latent preferences that different consumers actually have. And so, we get a wide variety of differentiated products precisely because this caters to people's preferences, whereas the neoclassical economist tends to see this all as waste. Advertising is just wasteful expenditure, and the monopolistically competitive firm is not producing, they're restricting output and raising their price beyond what they would if there were homogeneous units and we were in a perfectly competitive situation.
All right. I think the way to understand this then, I was hoping to avoid this, but I don't think you can. I think you do have to understand the stipulations of the perfectly competitive model to make sense of the rest of the conversation. I, by the way, am on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/456. I'm going to refer people not only to Rothbard, but also to this forgotten and very unattractively laid out book by Milton Shapiro, Foundations of the Market Price System, because he has a chapter toward the end on the perfect competition model that is concise and absolutely crushing. And if people want to understand exactly what we're talking about, I would refer them to that chapter. But I want to talk for a moment about the perfect competition, so-called, and then it's easier to compare that, because horizontal demand curve is a little obscure for the layman. So if we can understand these features, then we can understand what is considered problematic from the point of view of the mainstream. So first, what are the features of the perfectly competitive market, which basically everyone concedes more or less doesn't exist? I mean, you could come up with the example of the wheat farmer, but I bet if they looked for hard enough, they'd find reasons that even that's not perfectly competitive.
Yeah, that's right. So in the perfectly competitive market, there are a large number of sellers, each one selling such a small portion of the market that either their supply or withdrawal supply would not change the market price. So we have almost infinitesimally small sellers. They all sell homogeneous units of a good, so every seller sells exactly the same product as every other seller. There's no distinguishing feature, either geographically or in quality and so on and so forth, and that everyone in the market has perfect information. So it wouldn't be possible for advertising or presentation of better knowledge about location or so on to the buyer to be an advantage. And under those conditions, the conclusion is that all units of the good, no matter who the buyer or seller happens to be, would sell for exactly the same price, and that because each seller is such an infinitesimally small part of the market, each seller can sell an indefinite amount of the product at the given market price.
Well, what would you do in that case as a mainstream economist operating on this premise if I came back and said, let's imagine a world in which somehow all industries conform to these expectations. And so therefore, every consumer good, all examples of that good by all sellers would sell at the same price. But presumably there would be some differential, nevertheless, just in the matter of location. For example, if I'm drinking somebody sells me a bottle of wine on the side of the road in Boise, Idaho, and I sit there and consume it, That doesn't bring me the same satisfaction as consuming that bottle of wine at the top of the Empire State Building. But those are physically the same bottles of wine, and yet even in that world, wouldn't there be some differential in the price? How's that accounted for?
Yeah, it's not accounted for in the models of perfect competition. That feature reality is just assumed not to exist. And of course, the justification for all this modeling is that it gives us a nice trackable result that we can use to make predictions that are reasonably applicable to the real world. This, of course, is even the neoclassical economists recognize, though, that that's not entirely the case, and so they want to come up with these other modified versions of competition, like monopolistic competition or oligopoly, to have a more robust analytical apparatus.
Why was the perfectly competitive model introduced in the first place. I've heard some economists say that it's silly even to bother critiquing the model for being unrealistic because they concede that it's unrealistic. They don't mean it to approximate real markets. They use it for various analytical purposes.
Well, that would be, of course, if that's all they did, that would be somewhat unobjectionable, right? We wouldn't have a strong critique or reason to oppose it. One could invent all sorts of variations on assumptions to get at some analytical result that one wants, but that's not how they don't use it solely for that. It's not just a technique by which they can easily describe a general equilibrium. They use it as in a normative way to say that there are welfare losses to society if markets are imperfectly competitive.
What do they propose that we do about perfect competition, the requirements for it not being met? And what do they propose we do about monopolistic competition? Do they have policy recommendations?
Yeah, they tend to fixate on improving social welfare through the efficient, as they see it, the efficient allocation of resources. They would eliminate policies to eliminate all wasteful resource use. So they consider monopolistically competitive advertising as completely wasteful, and therefore they would ban it or force the different suppliers to homogenize their products, not to differentiate their products, and so on.
Okay, for example, there must be. I've tried to like Raisin Bran over the years, and I've never succeeded. I'm sure there are different companies that produce something like Raisin Bran. So would the idea be that, look, Raisin Bran is Raisin Bran, give or take. So the idea that you're going to spend resources showing a happy family eating Raisin Bran to get people to consume it is obviously a misuse of resources. So just sell your Raisin Bran on the merits and expend those resources on something that would be more socially valuable.
Yeah, that would be the idea. In fact, they might even advocate having the government provide standardized information. And so you get a lot of, in fact, of this as a justification for labeling and so on. And presumably the theory would be that would be sufficient. That would provide a kind of standard set of information that's what's really important to the consumer. You know, to know the details of the contents of the product or whatever it might be, but not this advertising that's done commercially to try to persuade consumers to buy the product.
All right, so let me make sure everybody's following then. What's happening is that this model of perfect competition so obviously does not approximate any world that's even conceivable that eventually this concept of monopolistic competition came along to try to make some concessions to reality. Although it's true that, let's say, Post cereal is the monopolistic producer of Post Raisin Bran, still a generic Raisin Bran is still Raisin Bran, but it's still something different. And they do have competitors. They're not the only supplier of cereal. They're not, even though they are the only supplier of their particular brand of cereal, still they obviously do have very close substitutes for that product in the form of other forms of cereal, so we'll acknowledge that. But at the same time, it's close enough that it's wasteful for them to be trying to spend so much time branding their own and distinguishing it in trivial ways and so on and so forth. Now, having said that, and having pointed out that the perfectly competitive model is not just used for theoretical purposes to help us flesh out some puzzles in economics, let me add that I, on the internet, come across people all the time who believe, based on their economics courses, that the requirements for perfect competition, that you have to have a whole bunch of sellers and the sellers have to be really, really small in terms of the overall market. They have to be so small that no matter what their decisions to produce or not to produce, the price of the good is unaffected. Everybody has perfect information about all this. People say to me that these are the requirements for a free market. And so we don't really have free markets. So you libertarians are, when you gripe about the government, you're griping about something that maybe the government can solve, that we don't have free markets now, but if the government intervenes, maybe we can come closer to free markets. And they can say that in all seriousness because of this model.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the big problem. You know, another aspect of this that we haven't discussed yet, you might want to throw in, is the Austrian conception of the of competition in the market is always dynamic. That is, it always accounts for the process that of resource use over time. Whereas these models of perfect competition, monopolistic competition, oligopoly, monopoly are completely and utterly static. And so when we think about the normative justification for state intervention, that also becomes an important point to make, that even if there is some monopolistic position by some particular firm right now, this tends to be washed away over time. And it's precisely this kind of activity of the entrepreneur, advertising and differentiating the product and so on, that accomplishes this improvement in resource allocation.
Well, let me raise a Bernie Sanders objection. You'll recall Bernie Sanders made the remark that here we have poverty, but yet at the same time we have, you know, dozens of brands of underarm deodorant. And isn't this a misallocation of resources? Well, from that standpoint, couldn't he very easily come along and say that certainly all the different advertising showing athletes using the Gillette brand and somebody else using the Right Guard brand, from a moral standpoint, this does seem like a waste of resources. Deodorant, you know, by and large, is deodorant. There are mild, there's small differences, but wouldn't it be better if we could take all that money that was spent on these silly campaigns and use it for, you know, relief of the suffering of the poor?
Yeah, I think there the question, of course, is what is the institutional framework or arrangement for doing just that? Will we interact with each other in society voluntarily? Will we, in other words, just do what entrepreneurs do in the market and try to persuade people that they ought not to spend so much on razor blades and they ought to give more to the poor? Or will we just use the power, the coercive power of the state, to force other people to adopt our own view of the world and you know, extract their wealth by force to provide this transfer to the poor?
Jeff, let's pause for just a moment for this message. Folks, it's a tough economy out there, but at the same time, there's never been an easier time to acquire marketable skills. You've got the internet. And case in point is a place called Code School, which you can visit through tomwoods.com/code. I'm intrigued by it. I've actually checked it out myself. You can become a web developer. You can become a better web developer than you already are. You can design apps. You can be involved in web design. The sky's the limit. And you can learn it cheaply, at your convenience, and in a way that's actually enjoyable. As a matter of fact, a listener of this show wrote into me and said, "I think it's awesome you're promoting self-taught web development stuff on your show. That's the field I'm in, and it's amazing to me how scarce the talent is. I've seen motivated friends of mine change career paths, self-teach, and land great jobs within 6 months' time. Definitely a great career." Get your free account through tomwoods.com/code. Jeff, in your course that you did for us, you've done a couple courses at libertyclassroom.com. You have a course that goes through chapter by chapter a very important and widely read mainstream economics textbook that a lot of college students would have read. The book by Nordhaus, Samuelson and Nordhaus, right? So yeah. Suddenly drawing up. I was thinking back to my own textbook, which was Baumol and Blinder, which is a totally different textbook.
Ah.
But anyway, so you go through chapter by chapter, and you have a couple of lectures on this particular question, and one of them has to do with whether monopoly is everywhere. And in the form of this monopolistic competition idea, it would seem to me that given that perfect competition in the form of the undifferentiated mass of producers producing undifferentiated products in very small amounts is, not only is it not likely to exist, but it's frankly kind of stupid sounding. Given that that doesn't exist anywhere, then does this not commit a mainstream economist to the proposition that in one form or another, monopoly is basically everywhere in the market economy?
Yeah, that's correct. I think that's absolutely correct. At least monopoly power, as they would put it, is ubiquitous. So they, again, would still distinguish between monopoly proper and, say, oligopoly, where there's a rudiment, at least, of the kind of business strategy that we think of when we think of entrepreneurship. But that's absolutely right. Every activity in the market is conducted with some degree of monopoly power.
Let me ask you a question that comes up sometimes in these sorts of discussions. A lot of times in a grocery store, the grocery store has to distinguish, has to discriminate among the vast array of brands of products that it could put on its shelves. For instance, if you go to the dollar store, you notice you encounter a lot of brands you would never see in the ordinary grocery store. Well, how does the grocery store come up with its decision as to what products to feature? Well, of course, it wants to feature the products that people are most likely to buy and products that it doesn't think it's going to get sued over, that sort of thing. But there are also cases where companies will pay to get shelf space for their product. And in this way, they can elbow out up-and-coming competitors. Now, how does an Austrian look at that and with a straight face say, there's nothing at all here we can describe as monopolistic? This is competition in the Austrian understanding. If that's true, then aren't the words competition and monopoly being defined by Austrians in ways that are just not reasonable?
Well, I think it has to be noted that the company that pays to get shelf space, you know, the ideal shelf space, obtains the revenue to make that payment from consumer demand. And so it's only because consumers are willing to pay more for that product that it commands the improved position. By the way, this is a generalizable problem, right? One of we might call quality. So all the entrepreneurs producing goods have to decide on the degree of quality of the good. And whether or not the buyers are willing to pay for that extra quality, will they generate the revenue that's necessary to provide this? I think this gets back to the issue we mentioned before about the market being a process, this dynamic, a process that unfolds over time. And this is the way in which Austrians define the competitive process. So it is true that we don't think of competition monopoly in this static way, and therefore our notion of competition, in a sense, transcends that, right? It doesn't really apply or take account of this static way of thinking or defining monopoly and competition.
Just to help me understand the whole thing better, let's use me as an example. Let's think about my services as a public speaker. How would a neoclassical economist look at my situation? Am I a monopolist because only I can give Tom Woods-style speeches? Or am I occupying a position in a monopolistically competitive environment in which there are fairly close substitutes? Other people can give libertarian speeches. They don't sound quite like mine. They wouldn't be delivered in the same way, but they're close enough. How do you think they'd look at that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I don't know of I've never read any articles by mainstream economists on the question of labor and the monopoly power of the worker, so to speak, or the nature of the competition in that respect. I mean, it is true that, let's say, manual labor, they would probably treat as perfectly competitive, that you're just supplying on the assembly line the same homogeneous labor service. But in this area you speak about of giving talks or in, let's say, entertainment is another example, surely they would have to recognize the, as they see it, the monopoly power, the differentiation of the product and the monopoly power that goes along with that. So yeah, you're a monopolist, Tom.
I'm thinking about that because I do think, well, what would an Austrian say about my particular situation? It does seem economically relevant to note that I have built up a reputation as a public speaker, and there are people who want to invite me, even though there are plenty of people who could give exactly as good a speech as I could give, precisely as good, to the extent that you can measure that, but yet they want me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm able to command a higher fee than other people because I'm the only me there is. There are substitutes, but there aren't other Tom Woodses.
Mm-hmm.
So because there aren't other Tom Woodses, I enjoy a monopolistic position from the neoclassical point of view. I'm the only seller. And so they would say, well, that's – I mean, presumably, if I were selling something other than labor services, they would clearly say that certainly in this niche, I at the very least have substantial monopoly power, and this helps to account for why I can get such a high fee. Well, what would the Austrians say? How would the Austrian analysis of my situation differ from that?
Oh, and by the way, Tom, you're not only a wicked monopolist, but you're obviously restricting supply. You're not working hard enough.
Oh, I know. I could be giving speeches every day.
That's right. That's right. So you're this double wickedness. You're charging this astronomical price, plus you're just a lazy bum.
Well, yeah, that's people knew that already.
Yeah, I'm sure that's how you assess the situation.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so the Austrian view, of course, is to point out that it's precise. This is an excellent example, precisely the emphasis of the Austrians on the entrepreneurial element of differentiating the product to cater to the preferences of people. So, you know, you're a lovable guy, Tom, and people like to have you around, and they like to interact with you. And when you give a speech, it's not just the words; it's the charisma and so on of the presentation, and all the personal touches and that you render, and so on. So the Austrians would say, "Well, this is just another example of how entrepreneurial foresight allows someone to command a higher valued product by satisfying consumers more fully."
All right. Before I let you go, I want to make sure everybody really understands this. Coke and Pepsi, I guess, would be an example where you have monopolistic competition, according to those people, because they're both selling cola.
Mm-hmm.
And not only are they both selling cola, they're both selling pretty much the same line of products.
Mm-hmm.
They both have something like Sprite. They both have, you know, just down the line. Now, but at the same time, clearly, Coke and Pepsi do not taste the same. When we're at a restaurant, my wife orders a Coke, and they say, "Pepsi, okay?" She says, "I'll just have water, please." Like, she just will not. She does not view that as a substitute. And I bet that's true of almost any of these products, even breakfast cereals. There are going to be people who have such a developed palate that they can tell the difference between these supposedly more or less indistinguishable things. The things that are distinguished supposedly only because the box is pretty or the advertising was compelling. But yet there are always consumers who can tell differences. So isn't it an unjustified ethical statement to say that it's wrong or stupid or wasteful to have advertising that tries to distinguish products that, in fact, really a lot of discriminating consumers can distinguish between?
Yes, that's exactly right. Hayek famously pointed this out, that you know, if it were true that advertising could just create demand artificially, then, of course, the expenses that were undertaken for production to actually make goods different would be unnecessary. You could just advertise your way to profits, and vice versa, right? No actual differentiation of the product and experience by the customer demanding that product more heavily could ever outweigh advertising. But we don't find the real world this way at all.
All right, I'm going to let you go at this point, but I want to refer people to the show notes page, tomwoods.com/456. I'll have some resources related to what we were talking about. And, of course, libertyclassroom.com. If you've been meaning to join that, well, by all means do, because not only do you get 13 courses, I'm about to add course number 14 by our friend Brad Berzer, but you also get access to Jeff Herberner's brain for a year, which is an incredible thing indeed. Jeff, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, everybody. Remember, if you are on the fence, maybe you are on the verge of jumping into the blogging game. Well, it's never been easier. I've made a video that shows you how to be up and running in 5 minutes with your new blog, plus get some free publicity from me. How do you do it? It's all explained over at tomwoods.com/publicity. How to get free publicity from me. How to start that blog in 5 minutes. How to do all kinds of neat things on your site, explained in the free ebook that you'll find at tomwoods.com/publicity. So definitely check that out. And of course, learn from Jeff Herbiner and others. I just had a great live session. We have live sessions once in a while at Liberty Classroom with Bob Murphy last night. It was great. So learn the history and economics they didn't teach you in courses you can listen to on the go, taught by people you can trust. Never again feel like I better not speak up because I just don't know enough. Now put that behind. That chapter of your life is closed. Head over to libertyclassroom.com and join us there, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.